Next, we'll hear the true story behind a prize-winning novel. It's the story of an American killed in World War I. Willa Cather told this story. She's a novelist known to generations of students for books like My Antonia, which is set on the Nebraska prairie. She also wrote a lot of personal letters, but banned their publication in her will.
Part of it was, I think, a management of her literary reputation, and part of it was a sense that evolved very late in her life that a writer should only be known through the artistic works they produced.
That's Andrew Jewell, who has now co-edited a book of Willa Cather's letters. Cather burned a few letters during her lifetime, but it became possible to publish the rest after her last literary executor died. The letters suggest what drove Cather to write about a mysteriously brave soldier. The book is called One of Ours. Despite the terms of her will, Jewell thinks Cather expected her remaining letters to eventually be published.
She didn't burn them, and in fact, in the last few years, a letter showed up where her niece, who had attended Willa Cather's funeral in New York, wrote to her family and said, "We must keep all of Aunt Willie's things safe from fire or something unexpected." And there's definitely this sense that there were precious materials that one day the world would want to see.
Okay, so we're going to read through and sort of annotate as we go.
Okay.
One of Willa Cather's letters. This is giving sort of the backstory of a novel she wrote and the true story on which it was based. Who's she writing to and what's the book?
The book is One of Ours, a novel that she won the Pulitzer Prize for, and she's writing to Dorothy Canfield Fisher. And Dorothy was a well-known writer and novelist herself in the day. This letter's from 1922.
Why don't you start off that letter for us?
"Dear Dorothy, yes, it will be classed as a war story, which means it will sell about 12,000, and God knows I never wanted to write a war story. I lost 6 months refraining from putting pen to paper on this one, but it stood between me and anything else."
Wow. We've already learned first that she's an exceedingly practical-minded writer. She has in her mind exactly how many copies this kind of book is going to sell.
Yes, and I think it's a little bit of a joke, you know, that she said she did not want this book to be marketed as a war story because she really thought it was not about the war. It was about this man, this boy and man whose character's name is Claude Wheeler. And she wanted to call the book Claude for a long time. And her publisher, Alfred Knopf, thought that would be a terrible title. And she was talked out of it and accepted the title One of Ours.
And we also learn here that she at least says she didn't even want to write this, but the subject forced her to write.
Yes, that's very consistent in Cather's way of discussing her writing. Once she became a mature writer, she always said she wrote about the subject she could not let go. There's a lot of, in some ways, practical reasons why she should not have written this book. That she was known by this point as a writer of Nebraska. You know, she had written My Antonia and O Pioneers by this point. And so to write a story about a young man who goes off to World War I is sort of out of her comfort zone.
So let's explain the true story behind the fiction. Read on from this letter of Willa Cather.
"It was like this. My cousin, Grosvenor, was born on the farm next my father's. I helped to take care of him when he was little. We are very much alike and very different. He could never escape from the misery of being himself except in action, and whatever he put his hand to turned out either ugly or ridiculous. There were years when we avoided each other. He had a contempt for my way of escape, and his own ways led to absurdities. I was staying on his father's farm when the war broke out. We spent the first week hauling wheat to town. On those long rides on the wheat, we talked for the first time in years, and I saw some of the things that were really in the back of his mind. I went away and forgot. I no more thought of writing a story about him than of writing about my own nose. It was all too painfully familiar. It was just to escape from him and his kind that I wrote at all."
This is, again, a brutally honest thing to say. Essentially, that she didn't even like this guy that she ended up becoming obsessed with and writing a book about.
And when you read the novel, you kind of get a sense of it. This character who, she says in a later book, well, it's part me, too, that this character, Claude Wheeler, who's based on Grosvenor, or also, he was also known as G.P. Cather, that he kind of was a person who was not a very strong person. He was intelligent but did not have good application of intelligence, did not have the confidence to make strong choices in his life. And Cather, as a woman who was so in control of her life, who was so confident in who she was from a very young age, I think had little interest in the kind of weakling that she understood her cousin to be. But it's to her credit that she saw him differently, you know, that she suddenly realized something about him and saw him with much more tenderness.
And in the next paragraph, she's going to describe what happened when he joined the army for World War I.
Yes, it continues. He went over in July 1917. He was killed at Cantigny, May 27th, on the next year. That anything so glorious could have happened to anyone so disinherited of hope. Timidly, angrily, he used to ask me about the geography of France on the wheat wagon. Well, he learned it, you see. I send you his citation. And I might stop here and add that he was the first officer from Nebraska killed in World War I, and he was given a citation for his bravery. He stood on a hill and directed fire toward the enemies, exposing himself to the guns and dying.
This man that she remembered as timid was courageous.
Yes.
Under fire.
Yes, and this was the great mystery, I think. I think it was a human mystery that this happened to her cousin.
Now the letter goes on to say how Willa Cather discovered his death.
Yes. I first came on it in the morning paper when I was having my hair shampooed in a hairdresser's shop. From that on, he was in my mind. The too personalness, the embarrassment of kinship was gone. But he was in my mind so much that I couldn't get through him to other things. It wasn't affection, but realization so acute that I could not get away from it. I never meant to write a story with a man for the central figure, but with this boy, I was all mixed up by accident of birth. Some of me was buried with him in France, and some of him was left alive in me.
Those are sentences powerful enough to have gone in the novel.
Yes. That is something that I think is true throughout her letters, that, you know, a letter, because it's a quickly written piece of correspondence to somebody, will contain some crude sentences and some asides that are kind of about the news of the day, but then things like that will be there too. And you realize that this wonderful writer left wonderful words in her letters to all sorts of friends and family, and it's a joy to read them. And it also brings such insight into the emotional life that gave birth to these great works of literature.
Andrew Jewell is an associate professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and co-editor of The Selected Letters of Willa Cather. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Sometimes life is like this. It took a tragedy for the journalist Rod Dreher to rediscover his hometown. As a teenager, Dreher could not wait to escape southern Louisiana. And then, as an adult, he went home for his sister's funeral. And Rod Dreher says that event demonstrated the value of community. This is the subject of his new book, The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, A Southern Girl, A Small Town, and the Secret of a Good Life. NPR's Debbie Elliott visited Dreher at home in St. Francisville, Louisiana.
On this bright spring day, Rod Dreher walks me down the historic block he now calls home. The houses have welcoming wide front porches. Just around the corner, tucked between sprawling oaks, is the United Methodist Church he grew up in, and where Ruthie Lemming's funeral was a year and a half ago.
People waited for hours for her wake to come in and pay their respects.
The line stretched more than a block.
It was a moment of intense grace. Do you want to walk in?
Yeah.
Should be open. Everybody leaves their churches open here. Here's the rope for the bell in the church, and Ruth and I's little children would jump up and grab the knots on the rope and pull the bell down after church.
Ruthie Lemming was just 42 years old when she died, a beloved middle school teacher married to an Iraq War veteran and local firefighter, her high school sweetheart. The town was rocked by her diagnosis. The Lemmings had touched many families here in some way or another, and during her 19-month battle with cancer, the community touched back in countless ways, caring for their three daughters, cooking meals, and raising money for her medical bills. This outpouring for his little sister struck Rod Dreher, who was living in Philadelphia with his family at the time.
I came to realize that the same social bonds that held me back as a young man were the things that was holding my family together and holding them up in their time of crisis.
Rod Dreher had long ago left this part of Louisiana, just up the Mississippi River from Baton Rouge. His journalism career had taken him to Washington, D.C., New York, Dallas. He'd become a city dweller who rubbed shoulders with important and famous people. During those years away, a divide was growing.
It was very hard for my family to understand why I did what I did, in part because they were such people of the place and of the land.
In particular, his father and sister Ruthie thought Rod's place was back home with them.
And they saw my desiring something different as a sign of disorder and of disloyalty and of rejection. And that's something that Ruthie and I never were able to resolve.
The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming is part memoir, part tribute, and part exploration of the cultural ties that bind. A key character in the book is St. Francisville Dr. Tim Lindsay. His daughter is a close friend of one of the Lemming girls. I met him in the exam room where Ruthie Lemming first came to get a second opinion about a nagging cough.
I noticed there was something not right.
Ruthie was so short of breath she couldn't finish her sentences. Tests confirmed the worst. Lung cancer, and it spread to her brain.
It actually is the blessing and the curse of being in my own hometown practicing medicine, because the blessing is that I get to have a front row seat to these real life dramas, that I'm able to serve in a way with people that I know and I love and I'm invested in. The curse is that it might be my daughter's best friend's mom.
The response from people like Tim and Laura Lindsay and other family friends got Rod Dreher thinking about what his sister was building back home while he was off building his career. The barn dances, campfires, and lazy days down by the creek, he writes, are like a levee they had spent a lifetime building together. And in the catastrophe of her cancer, the levee was holding.
Oh, careful, Anna.
Rod Dreher and Ruthie's best friend, Abby Temple Cochran, spread a mess of boiled crawfish over newspaper at Ronnie Morgan's camp, a sprawling expanse of green that leads down to the white sand beaches of Thompson Creek.
It's Star Hill Riviera.
Star Hill is the rural community outside St. Francisville where the Dreers have lived for generations. Ruthie and her friends spent most weekends here at Ronnie's camp. On this early spring evening, Rod and Ruthie's mom joins the gathering.
Hey, how y'all doing?
I'm ma'am.
Everybody calls Dorothy Dreher ma'am. She seems to enjoy Ruthie's friends telling the story of how they stood watch with her casket the night before the funeral, painting her nails and sprinkling in a little sand from the Riviera.
I bedazzled her. Glittered I put a little bit of glitter on her.
We glittered her up.
The next day, Ruthie's pallbearers were barefoot as they carried her casket to the Star Hill Cemetery in honor of Ruthie's carefree spirit and general dislike of footwear. All stories that Rod Dreher tells in The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming. Ma'am just finished reading the book.
I finally got through it, but it was hard. It was reliving what I'd already lived and told the truth about things, you know. We're just normal people. We're just old country people, you know.
People who got by, she says, because Ruthie forced a good face.
She didn't let you, even though I saw it, you know, you just, well, we got another day today. Well, we got another day today, you know. And you just keep thinking, well, I got another day.
Her friend and longtime neighbor, Ronnie Morgan, was there when the days ran out.
What'd you like, lose more than your own?
It's hard to talk about that day, so Ronnie Morgan changes the subject and, always quick with a joke, starts ribbing Rod.
He way too smart for Star Hill.
The joke hits a nerve, the same struggle that Rod had with his sister Ruthie and his father. The two men stand in the rustic wood-paneled camp house, Ronnie Morgan decked in overalls and sipping a can of Miller beer, Rod Dreher in his heavy horn-rimmed glasses with a strawberry ale, reaching for common ground. Ronnie tells Rod that some good has come from the family's tragedy.
Well, first place, it kind of showed you what the true meaning of life was.
Yeah, it's true.
And, you know, the family and your values, you can't buy that. When I'm gone, the only thing that's going to show up to say I was here is the people I left behind.
And the way they carry on in your absence. In the book, Rod quotes Ruthie's husband, Mike, telling a friend, "We're leaning, but we're leaning on each other." And that's the Louisiana community that Rod Dreher once again calls home. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
And you can hear Rod Dreher read from The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming at NPR.org.
Ancient and unusual trees grace national parks and botanical gardens, but you'll also find them growing in the middle of busy cities and sprouting from highway medians. Those are the kind of trees Benjamin Sweat celebrates in a new book called New York, City of Trees. NPR's Margot Adler took a walk with him to visit some of the great trees of the city.
Sweat first takes me to Alley Pond Park in outer eastern Queens. It's noisy. The park stands in the middle of the Long Island Expressway and several other highways. He points to what may be the tallest tree in Queens and tells me that tulip trees like this, along with white oaks and white pines, were the original tree-filled landscape when Henry Hudson arrived in 1609.
It comes out of the earliest times. I mean, it may not have started growing itself when Henry Hudson came, but it brings us back to the times when Native Americans lived in this area and when these woods were what the whole of New York City looked like.
Looking down and up at it from a bluff on high, it's huge. No one has cored the tree, so we don't know its age. But 13 years ago, when it was last measured, it stood 134 feet tall. Sweat next takes me to Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn, not a place you would think of for unusual trees. But there, next to some nondescript brownstones, is a southern magnolia with its huge, waxy green leaves and white flowers when it blooms. Sweat says it shouldn't even be here.
It's much too cold for it here, but we think that by literally hugging the side of this row of brownstones, it received enough warmth to remain growing through all of the severities of the northern winters.
There's a mural on the wall dedicated to Hattie Carthen, an African-American woman who saved the tree when developers wanted to tear it down. She convinced the Landmark Preservation Commission that the tree was so unusual it should be preserved along with the brownstones that protected it, and they were. We walk into a concrete playground in Flushing, Queens, where a huge cedar of Lebanon sits within a protected gate. It's another tree that's hard to grow in the city, but can live for 1,000 years in the Middle East. Also in Queens, we go to Cassina Park, which in the 19th century was a nursery run by the Parson family. And it's where Frederick Law Olmsted and Calvert Vaux got many of the trees they planted in Central and Prospect Park. We come across some beautiful katsura trees in nursery straight rows. This tree originally covered the world, but later only survived in Asia. Why is it now in backyards all over the United States?
In the middle of the 19th century, a consul to Japan, who had been appointed by President Lincoln, sent some seeds back to his brother in Brooklyn.
And he passed them on to the Parson family. Sweat says trees actually connect people with the city physically.
Each growth layer that they put on every year contains a bit of the air from that year transformed into carbon. And so the tree physically holds the years and years of the life of the city.
And of course, trees become part of people's lives, their history and memories. The last tree we look at is back in Manhattan. I confess I've passed it probably 100 times, walking through Greenwich Village and Washington Square Park. Like so many, I never noticed it, although it's probably 220 years old, an English elm, 135 feet high, when last measured almost 30 years ago.
This tree, for many years, was known informally around the city as the Hangman's Elm because it was thought that during the American Revolution, traitors had been hung from one of its long branches that used to snake out over the nearby street.
Turns out hangings did not take place on the tree, but there may have been a gallows nearby, and the elm was probably planted in the 1790s. Benjamin Sweat's new book, New York City of Trees, has pictures and stories of some 60 great trees in the city. He says trees have psychological and emotional meaning we often don't even realize until the tree is cut down, and a couple of trees in his book are already gone. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Last up this hour, a controversy over Wikipedia and the status of women writers. A recent op-ed in the New York Times pointed out that women were being moved off of Wikipedia's list of American novelists. They were being placed in their own separate category. As NPR's Lynn Neary reports, that sparked charges of sexism and a lively debate on Wikipedia.
It all started when writer Amanda Filipacchi was browsing through Wikipedia one night when she noticed an absence of women under the category American novelists. At first, she thought the women writers being moved off the page were not important enough to be on it. But then she discovered some very obscure male novelists were still listed, and some very well-known women were not.
Donna Tartt, Anne Rice, Harper Lee, Anne Beattie, there are lots and lots of them.
These writers and many more were being systematically moved to a new list called American Women Novelists. Filipacchi says someone at Wikipedia thought the list of American novelists had just gotten to be too big.
And so they have to find ways to find subcategories, and they consider that women writers is a very good subcategory, for example. And most of those subcategories are genres like science fiction, thriller, mystery, and then women writers, as though women novelists are a genre of writing.
Filipacchi wrote about her discovery in the New York Times, charging Wikipedia with sexism. Soon after, the American novelist page disappeared, then reappeared. Women's names gravitated back onto the list. Filipacchi says someone tampered with her own Wikipedia page, and a massive discussion of the issue got underway. Ryan Caldari is an editor at Wikipedia.
The debate that's going on right now, it's actually still ongoing. So far, it looks like there's been about 33,000 words of discussion on it, which is quite a lot, which is actually more than, you know, the novel Animal Farm.
Caldari says the editor who moved the names of women writers off the page violated Wikipedia's guidelines about gender-specific pages, and the problem is in the process of being addressed. He says it's not the first time Wikipedia has been accused of sexism.
Wikipedia does have problems with sexism because, as a lot of people know, only about 10% or less of the editors of Wikipedia are women. And so a lot of times there's kind of this subconscious, you know, white male privileged sexism that exists on Wikipedia that isn't really acknowledged.
Caldari says he is surprised that this particular issue attracted so much attention. But novelist Meg Wolitzer says this is just the latest example of women writers being relegated to second shelf status.
Well, I think we're still stuck to some extent on these ideas of books written by different genders and that they have different roles in the world of literature.
Wolitzer says some women novelists don't mind if their books are categorized as women's fiction, but she does.
We've seen first-rate novels by women sometimes sort of thoughtlessly grouped together as women's fiction. And that's a phrase that can make me a little bit crazy. I mean, what is women's fiction? Do these books have anything in common, or is it just that the authors were all at one time or another in possession of a uterus?
For her part, Amanda Filipacchi says she believes Wikipedia has no choice but to address the issues she's raised.
It's so laughable. I think in 20 years, or hopefully in 1 year, looking back on this, people won't even believe that this was going on.
Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
There's that singular anomaly, the lady novelist. Well, I don't think she'd be missed. I'm sure she'd not be missed.
You're listening to All Things Considered. Just across the Rio Grande from El Paso, Texas, a few blocks into Mexico, sits an old Prohibition-era bar. It's called the Kentucky Club, and it's a legendary spot that's long attracted customers from both sides of the border. It's also the place that weaves together a collection of short stories by the American writer who won this year's prestigious Pen Faulkner Award. Monica Ortiz Uribe of member station KJZZ joined the author on a trip to his favorite bar.
We're walking across the bridge that links downtown El Paso to Ciudad Juarez. For a Saturday night, it's hauntingly still. What used to be a border crossing flush with life is now, after years of brutal drug violence, like a graveyard. It's not the border, author Benjamin Alire Sainz recalls from his high school days.
We'd all pile in a couple of cars. There'd be like 10 of us. And we'd come over to Juarez. And we'd go to all these places like the Cave, the Club Hawaii, the Kentucky Club. And we would just have a good time and laugh.
Ciudad Juarez is a sprawling city of more than a million people. It lies directly south of El Paso, like a muddled reflection off a mostly arid Rio Grande River. This is home for Sainz. The border is more than just a place in his stories. It's a silent but ever-present character. His latest book, Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club, introduces readers to a famous Juarez bar, which is our destination tonight. Unlike the border bridge, the Kentucky Club is pulsing with energy. With a declining murder rate in Juarez, locals are going out again. Most Americans, though, are still reluctant to return. Behind the Grand Oak Bar, a one-eyed bartender in a white-collared shirt stirs up the Kentucky Club's signature drink. Locals like to brag that this is the birthplace of the margarita, a disputed claim at best. This place has been around since 1920, when Prohibition drew in throngs of thirsty Americans. I ask Sainz why he picked the Kentucky Club for his book.
It's the knot that has, for generations, tied the two cities of Juarez and El Paso together. That's why this place, because it's still here.
His book is not about the Kentucky Club. It's just the place where his characters like to end up. The book is about the lives of people on the border, those who slide between the two countries as if they were two neighborhoods. There are love stories, stories about drug addiction, coming of age, and identity.
Imagine someone in El Paso loving someone in Juarez, and imagine that person getting killed. That happens. That's happened. So I just put it in a story.
Sainz Publisher is a small, family-run company in El Paso called Cinco Puntos Press. They take pride in publishing authors with diverse backgrounds whose work often carries a political message. John Byrd runs the shop with his parents.
I think that too often news and information about the border is generated away from the border. And so what we're really hoping to do is to allow the border to speak for itself.
Sainz grew up on the border. At 26, he became a Catholic priest, a calling that only lasted 3 years. After that, his future belonged to writing. His 19 works include poetry, children's books, and novels. A.J. Verdell is a fellow writer and a judge for the Penn Faulkner Foundation. She helped choose Sainz's book out of 351 entries.
I felt like I was reading about the United States and Mexico. I felt like I was reading about permanence and transference, that is, crossing back and forth. There's a tremendous tension of duality in this book, and it definitely made the book better and more complex.
Back at the Kentucky Club, Sainz takes a long drag from a cigarette. As William Faulkner wrote about the American South, he says, he writes about the American border.
We're people who feel and breathe and die and suffer and hope for salvation and yearn for love. We're not just a newspaper headline.
Sainz and four finalists for the Penn Faulkner Award will be honored in May at a public ceremony in Washington, D.C. For NPR News, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe in El Paso.
And that story came to us from Fronteras, a public radio collaboration in the Southwest focusing on the border and its changing demographics. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.